I could go in and try and find a fire extinguisher, but figured that wouldn't be the best utilization of my time, considering the circumstances. My eyes remained on the Chevy, the back access door, and the rear passenger side hung partially ajar, and I could see where Shade had run the van into the SUV, forcing it onto the pump island. One of the gas handles lay on the melted asphalt, the hose burned and gone. I stepped in closer and carefully counted the bodies and then walked around the vehicle and searched the surrounding area just to be sure. Back inside, Sizer Vittoria was talking to McGroder, and the agent's color was a little better. Sancho broke off when he saw the look on my face. What?
Mike, how many of your people were in the other Suburban?
His head shook, but his eyes were steady.
Two of mine and a marshal. Three.
Sancho glanced back at McGroder as I bundled up, and we watched the fire bank itself and dwindle even further in the face of the sleet, snow, and cold. The Basco's voice was tight.
I think he's going to make it.
He's tough, but you need to keep him talking.
Yeah, I know. Sancho's dark eyes reflected the waning fire as he spoke. What are you going to do? I sighed. I'll take a sweep between here and Boulder Park to make sure the convicts are not in a ditch. If they aren't, Ironcloud will have a better chance of seeing them on his way up. No word from Joe or Tommy on the Ameritrans van?
No.
What about Beatrice Linwood's blazer?
The Basco looked grim and then tried to put a good face on a situation that had none. He didn't say anything, but if this Beatrice Linwood lives in Ten Sleep, wouldn't he have seen her?
Call him back and ask him to check it.
I will.
He bit the inside of his lip, a habit he'd picked up from me.
What are you thinking?
I pulled out my pocket watch and read the time, creeping up on 10 o'clock. I'm thinking that an awful lot of our bad eggs just got out of the basket, and I'm afraid they've got one of ours with them.
What do you mean?
There are only two bodies out there, and the cargo door was open. I think he took whatever was behind the seats and the woman agent, Pfaff.
Why in the hell would he do that?
She's the one he's been talking to, and he's going to need insurance. I hustled back to the bar and placed a hand on McGroder's shoulder. He was definitely looking better. I glanced at the can of root beer Sancho had found on the shelves.
You want another sip?
The agent grinned.
Only if you got something stiffer.
No such luck. I cleared my throat. I've got bad news. It looks like you're going to make it. He laughed slightly.
So, what's the good news?
I think he's got one of your agents. The grin faded.
Casey Pfaff?
I nodded. All the roads are blocked on both sides of the mountains, but I'm going to make a quick loop a little west of here. I'm hoping they're in a ditch, so I might be able to round things up quick.
He'll kill you.
He said it like taxes. I patted his shoulder.
I'm kind of hard to kill.
Yeah, I know. I talked to a buddy of yours who's in the bureau, a guy by the name of Cliff Cly, but still...
I turned to grin. Let me guess, Cly was reassigned to the licensing office in Nome, Alaska?
Something like that. He says, you punch like a mule kicks.
I shrugged. He's overly kind. Look, McGroder, I've got to get out there. His voice took a different tone, and his sable eyes focused on me unlike they had before, as his hand grasped my sleeve.
I'm not screwing around here, Sheriff. Listen to me. If you go after him alone, he'll kill you. Wait for backup and...
I took a breath and leaned in. I'm just going up the road a bit. His face remained immobile.
You'll never come back.
I smiled at him, but it was one of those moments when everything freezes in time. I could hear the coolers laboring away, the sleet on the roof, and the last few dying sounds of the fire outside. You know those moments are a signpost, something telling you that you shouldn't go any farther, the ones you try and ignore. As I hurried toward the door, the Basco intercepted me.
Hey, are you sure you want to do this alone?
Yep, I'm sure. I'm sure I don't, but there isn't anybody else for the job. He started to interrupt, but I cut him off before he could get going. With your experience in corrections, you have a lot more medical training. If he goes into cardiac arrest, you might actually be able to do something about saving him. He studied me, knowing full well I wasn't telling him everything, including the promise I'd made to his wife. He was holding something out to me.
What's this?
It's my day pack with supplies. I found some stuff behind the counter. Candy, granola bars, a couple of cans of pop, some chips, chewing gum. I took the bag and slung one of the straps onto my shoulder.
Well, at least my breath'll be kissing sweet. He stared at me. I swear, Vic was the only one who got my jokes. I'll be right back.
They took all the satellite phones that the feds had, except this one, that they must have missed. They're these Motorola Iridiums, high-end fed stuff that might have about 30 hours of power left in them, so take this one.
I didn't take it.
Then you have no phone. He glanced at Magruder. They know where we are.
I still didn't take it.
He handed me his cell phone that he had carefully wrapped in a Ziploc bag. Well, at least take this. Maybe you'll find a signal. I took the phone, but balked when he tried to hand me his Beretta. I patted the .45 on my hip. I've got a weapon. Anyway, in this weather, they might come back. I took a deep breath of the warm air.
Do me a favor, call Ruby and report in.
Tell her what's going on, but don't make it sound too dramatic. Also, have her see what she can come up with on Beatrice Linwood's record. Got it. I didn't move, so he shoved the .40 back in his holster. Look, when Benton was moving their stuff into our van, he put a gun case in the back section. It wasn't long enough to be a full-fledged rifle, but it looked longer than the Mossbergs they were carrying, so I asked him. He said it was one of those Armalites with laser sights. I snorted a laugh.
Great.
I nodded and put a hand on the metal bar that stretched across the door. If I find the vehicle, I'll get it, and a satellite phone.
Keys?
He nodded toward the Suburban. They're in it.
How trusting of you.
I smiled, but he didn't smile back.
It was, as the Basco had said, like driving on greased goose shit. And now it was really dark, with a skim of snow on the road that made it even slicker. The Suburban was heavy, and I started slowing the extended SUV before Willow Park, but still locked the wheels in a left-hand turn that resulted in my sliding into the crusty snow at the side of the road and knocking over one of the 10-foot reflector poles. Well, hell.
I threw the Chevy into reverse and easily backed off the roadside and onto the snow-covered asphalt. I hit the brakes and could feel the whole truck slide backward an extra 4 feet.
Wonderful. At this rate, I'll be in 10 sleep by Memorial Day.
I dropped the gear selector down into D and pulled back into the flow of things, slowed a little, and was able to keep the Suburban on the road as my mind raced ahead. All the signs pointed to Beatrice Linwood and Shade being in cahoots, the bobby pin keys in the sandwiches, her turning west instead of east, the fact that she hadn't been able to keep her eyes off of him at the lodge. But the Ameritrans van was another story. Why hadn't it arrived at Joe Ironclouds or Tommy Wayman's roadblocks at the base of the mountain? The snow continued to collect on the conifers, and they began looking like rib cages in the contrast of light and dark as I thought about all the loose strings. It was after I had made the last curve before hitting the downslope that I saw lights shooting up at an angle. It was a steep embankment alongside a relative straightaway, but there was something odd about the reflection. As I got closer, I could see that it was not one vehicle in the barrow ditch, but two. I crept the Suburban to a stop about 30 yards away, cut the motor, and put on the flashes along with the light bright, the name my daughter Katie had given the emergency bars on the roofs of my assorted cruisers. I directed the spotlight at the vent window, a term from my own youth, and illuminated the wreckage. It was Beatrice Linwood's blazer and the Ameritrans convict transport van. From the slush marks and the point where the two vehicles had crashed their way through the snow piled by the road, I was pretty sure that she had driven into their vehicle at the front driver's side. With her greater velocity, she'd been able to push the much heavier step van into the ditch where it had partially rolled over and now lay on its side. Drawing my Colt, I stepped from the Suburban, careful to take a wide stance, which resulted in my sliding a good 9 inches on the glassy surface of the road. I let out a breath, and it sounded like a rattler uncoiling in my lungs, the condensation blowing back in my face with the smell of snakes. I minced a few steps toward the front of the Chevy and could see the body of another one of the federal marshals, lightly covered with splatters of the wet snow, lying beside the ditch. Damn! I eased past the grillwork and crouched by the man's outstretched hand. There's nothing quite so still as the dead, an otherworldly stillness. His flesh was frozen, and there was no movement in him. His coat was missing, along with his boots and weapons, the sidearm and the shotgun. Crouching a little, I pulled my hat on tighter, just to keep it from sailing off with the wind, and started down the slope. The lights were still on inside both vehicles, but the ones from the old blazer were starting to dim to a sickly yellow. The main cargo doors of the reinforced van were open. I couldn't see anyone inside, but could see the restraints that had attached the convex lying in the doorway. Slipping my maglite from my belt, I focused the beam into the cavernous space where the prisoners should have been but weren't. I played the light over the cab of the blazer, but no one was there either. The tracks led back up the hillside and onto the road. A lot of tracks. If I was to make an assumption, it would be that Shade had picked up all of the survivors in our DOC van. I scanned the surrounding area again and then continued to the front of the transport. The driver was there, leaning against his seat belt, and he was painfully and obviously dead, as was the man in the passenger seat. They'd both been shot at close range with one of the 40 pistols. I rested an elbow on the cracked windshield and listened to something in the distance, something unnatural. It was a whining noise that rose and fell and then stopped. I listened some more but could hear nothing except the wind. The collar of my sheepskin jacket was providing little protection, but I improved the odds by pulling it up higher and buttoning the top button. I took a second to think about the numbers. That meant 6 fugitives, including Beatrice Linwood and 2 hostages, Pfaff and the other Ameritrans guard. Just to make sure no one was hanging around, I checked the front of the blazer at closer quarters, but it was indeed empty. Slogging my way back up the hillside, I remembered Santiago's cell phone and pulled it out of the Ziploc. I flipped open the face of the device and watched as it searched for service. After about a minute, I decided it was another opportunity to wait for Memorial Day, and pocketed the useless thing. I pulled the federal marshal completely from the road and covered his face with his hat. It was all I could do for now. The Suburban started up easily, and I punched off the emergency lights and flashers. If I ran into the DOC van farther down the highway, they weren't likely to pull over. I kept the spotlight pointed in the general direction of the roadside and pulled out. I'd gone about a quarter of a mile when something caught my eye, and I stood on the brakes. It was the main entrance to Deer Haven, another of the shuttered lodges in the throes of renovation. The Chevrolet slid sideways, but finally stayed on the road. I refocused the spotlight and could see a clear set of tire tracks leading into the deep snow. Gotcha. I wheeled the SUV into the entranceway, careful to avoid the deeper drifts to the left and the remnants of the broken swing gate where they had crashed through. The padlock was still hanging on the post to the right. There was a single dusk-to-dawn fixture about 30 feet above the ground, with a bulb that created a giant, illuminated halo that lit up the blowing snow but didn't shed much light on too much else. I repositioned the Suburban spotlight into the gloom. Up ahead there was a Forest Service bridge with a large drift blocking the road, and it looked as if they'd attempted to head up West Tensleet Road but had been turned back. The tracks showed that they had reversed and then swung around just ahead of me and plunged into the area where the parking lot would have been. This was when a smart man would have parked the Suburban at the head of the road and waited for backup. And I thought about it. It was going to take hours for my reinforcements to get here, if they ever did. And I had a federal agent and a transport officer being held hostage. I applied the simple rule that allowed me to make stupid decisions in these types of situations. If I was down there, would I want someone coming after me? Yep. I swept the spotlight to the left and could see the complex of low-slung, dark log cabins, but no van. The tracks led straight across the flat area in front of the cabins and then turned to the right away from the main lodge. I drove slowly in their path and finally saw the van parked between 2 of the log structures that sat in a row. The place was a bushwhacker's wet dream, with an assortment of cabins surrounding the 75-yard open area which I'd just crossed. They'd had enough time so that they could be anywhere. I followed the path the van had cut in the parking lot and saw that the DOC vehicle had gone off the edge of the gravel and buried itself in the drift between the cabins. The noise I'd heard back on the side of the road must have been them trying to spin their way out in two-wheel drive. There didn't seem to be anybody in the van, so at least I knew one place they weren't. Figuring there was no reason to give them a very clear target, I shut off the headlights on the Suburban. Also figuring that for my purposes, it was just as good to have things be as quiet as possible, I went ahead and killed the engine. I pulled out my Colt and slammed it into the light in the Suburban's overhead console. Bits of plastic fell into the passenger seat, but I thought not giving them another target as I opened the door was a terrific option. Let the government bill me. I pulled the keys, opened the door, and stepped into the snow, the surface crusty from sleet. Something fell out along with me. When I looked down, I could see it was Sarza Pretorius' pack that now lay on the snow-dappled steps leading to the porch of one of the cabins. I kicked it aside and figured I'd pick it up when I got back to the vehicle. There were no windows on the sides of the two structures that faced each other, only small ones in the fronts, along with glass panels in the two doors. There was no movement that I could detect inside either cabin. I'd checked them again after I searched the van. I eased the door shut and started toward the back of the DOC vehicle. I was pleasantly surprised to see that the occupants had all gotten out through the sliding door at the side and continued on past the cabins to the left. As far as I could tell, the only electricity that worked was the dawn-to-dusk at the entrance of the parking lot. There probably was no heat either, and huddled in one of the cabins or the main lodge, the group was most likely breaking up furniture to burn in one of the small fireplaces in an attempt not to freeze to death. The bodies of the two marshals were still lying on the floorboard of the van, both of them, as Magruder had indicated, having been dispatched with one of the appropriated shotguns and at close range. Benton was the nearest, so I reached out and closed his eyes. Once again, there was little else I could do. The convicts had taken everything, including the steak knife that I had left on the dash. I started to return to the rear cargo door, where Santiago said that Benton had stored the enhanced Armalite. I figured I'd feel a lot better if I could get a proper rifle in my hands. Something moved above me. I scrambled back against the cabin wall and raised the big Colt. My back thumped against the dark brown logs, and I stood there in a two-handed grip, trying to get my blood pressure under control. There was a loud snarl, like the kind you hear in the movies, but this one was up close and real. I figured it was going to take a couple of hours to get the hair on the back of my neck to lie back down. As Lonnie Littlebird would say, she was a big one, but she was thin, and I was lucky she didn't have cubs or I might have been dead. She snarled down at me and backed her haunches into the cove section of the twin-peaked roof of the cabin on the other side of the van. Her eyes were the only things I could see. I'd never been this close to a mountain lion, and I had to admit that, even snarling with a ferocity that vibrated my own lungs, she was a beauty. Evidently, she'd taken advantage of the shelter provided by the overhang that gave her the ability to stay covered yet capable. I guess she hadn't moved when the van had pulled in, but when I'd driven up and started poking around, she'd decided enough was enough. I waved my sidearm at her, and I'll be damned if she didn't slam a paw as big as dog's into the roof of the cabin in order to back me off. I stood there a little surprised. The big cats usually aren't so tenacious when confronted with human beings. I guess she figured there was nowhere better to go, and she'd been there first. "Come on, get out of here. I'll be damned if I'm going to march around waiting for you to hurtle off onto me. Scat!" I waved the pistol again, but she pushed herself deeper into the alcove. We were at a standoff, and there wasn't much more I could do to make her move. With one more glance, I eased around the van and shot a breath from my nose, pulling the handle on one of the rear doors. Just as the Basco had said, there was a Hardig polyethylene deployment case lying there, olive drab, my favorite color, or so the Marine Corps had taught me. I gave another look to the roof of the cabin where I hoped the cougar was still crouched, stuffed my fingertip into my mouth, and yanked the glove off with my teeth. I slipped my naked hand into the plastic handle and pulled the case toward me. I was always amazed at how light the M-Series rifles were. They had always felt like plastic toys. I flipped open the anti-shear latches and opened the case, revealing the foam cavities for a full cleaning kit and extra magazines and the laser sight. There was a cutout for an M203 grenade launcher with accessories, which had been filled in with foam. The attachment had obviously not been in there. The problem was, neither was the short-barreled rifle. It was about then that I noticed, for just an instant, a tiny green dot reflected in the van's rear window. Chapter 5. I threw myself sideways, multiplying the speed of my descent by slipping on the ice. The report of the 223 was very loud. I hit the ground with a grunt, immediately following the sharp spack of the bullet going through the back window of the closed half of the van where I'd been standing. I rolled over and looked at the bullet hole in the glass, small shards and snow still floating down on me as I reconsidered what an intelligent man would have done in this situation. I had an image of my smarter self munching on a year-old Snickers bar, seated in the relative warmth of the Suburban, which I would have parked at the road head. It's a maxim that in these situations, the first person to move is the first person to die. It was possible that the shooter thought he'd hit me, and I could wait to see if he'd show, but that meant lying in the snow, exposed for longer than I really cared to be. If I wanted a clear view, I was going to have to crawl out from between the two vehicles, which meant really showing myself, something I was loath to do. I reached over and picked up my hat, dusting it off and placing it back on my head. Small comforts, but I always felt better with my hat on. There were noises coming from the other side of the parking lot, and then some voices. I couldn't make out what any of them were saying, but they said a few things to each other, and then it was silent again. I waited for a few moments more and then looked around the passenger side fender. With the blowing snow, it was almost like playing tag in a river. There was someone outside, and I just caught the fleeting image of a man darting past the windows on the porch of the main lodge. It looked to me as if he were carrying one of the shotguns, which meant that someone else was probably still out there with the 223, and that the runner was going to try and flank me from the cabins at my rear. I had to move, but I wasn't going to attempt crossing the lot, not with the Armalite waiting for the possibility of another lucky shot in the current conditions. If I squeezed past the DOC van and right, I'd probably meet the shooter somewhere out there. I leveraged up on my elbows and knees and glanced back to see if I could triangulate the rifle fire. It looked like it had come from slightly to my right, the same basic area where I'd seen somebody moving at the main lodge. I crouched and moved, picking up the Basco's backpack as I went, sliding between the van and the cabin where the cougar had been. The snow slid off the van and landed on my hat and shoulders. I didn't wipe it off this time, in hopes that it might provide some cover from the scope. But when I turned my head, there was a Sig Sauer P226 muzzle pointed up and under my chin. "Move back!" With the shadows, it was difficult to see who was holding the semi-automatic, but hearing the Latino accent, I had a good idea. I retreated with my .45 held above my head. "Hey, Hector, raise your arms and shut up." As he stepped into the minimal light afforded by the parking lot lamppost, I could see the pant leg of his orange jumpsuit and the tactical boots that he must have taken from the dead marshal. He also wore a 3/4-length parka, which he must have appropriated from the convict transport. He motioned for me to move to my right. "Step over there." I did as instructed, and knowing that a little cover was better than none, was careful to place myself between the DOC van and the Suburban. Hector stepped around as well, carefully holding McGroder's Sig at an angle, gangster style. He raised a hand to his face and yelled back toward the main lodge, "Got him!" I shifted with my hand still above my head, and his eyes darted back to me. "I said don't move." "Actually, you didn't. Shut up." He paused and turned slightly as we heard noises coming from the big building. "And give me your gun." I thought about my situation, how I was soon to be surrounded by some very desperate and well-armed individuals. I thought about how the odds of one-on-one were a hell of a lot better than five-on-one. With my hand still raised, I tossed the Colt up onto the roof of the van. Otero looked at me. "What the fuck?" I shrugged. "You said to get rid of the gun." He studied me from the depths of his acrylic-lined hood. "What, you don't think I can get up there or what?" "Well, you are kind of short." He gestured with the 40 for me to back up, which I did with my hand still raised, as he placed a foot on the door sill of the van and pulled himself up by the gutter rail.
"Fuck you, Alexander Domas!"
He really was kind of short and had to reach across the top of the snow-covered van with one hand while keeping his pistol pointed at me. It was quite a balancing act. I retreated another step.
"I said don't move!"
The wind blew another gust from the roof of the cabins and pushed the hood of Hector's parka against his face. He kept yanking it back, but it continued blowing forward. I was beginning to wonder how much movement it was going to take. To give her credit, she didn't make a sound until she moved, and when she did, it was something to behold. She bounced once to contain her speed and swiped out with a massive paw at Hector's hooded head. He jumped when the sound and fury came out of the alcove, and his foot slipped on the wet sill. The cougar's lethal claws raked the cloth on the top of his head. His face was pushed forward by the force of her swipe, and he flipped backward to land at my feet. The SIG should have gone off, but it didn't. I landed all 250 pounds on his chest with a knee and listened to the air go out of him, which for a moment stopped the screaming, and then the semi-automatic popped from his hand. It was a calculated risk, turning my back to the cougar, but I figured Hector was the moment's primary threat. I snatched the 40 from the snow and then whirled to face the mountain lion, but she'd stayed on the roof of the van and was snarling and spitting.
"Shoot! Shoot the motherfucker! Shoot!"
Evidently Hector had gotten his wind back.
"Shoot!"
She slapped the roof of the van again with her big paws, and I guess she was waiting to see who, between Hector and me, was going to come out on top. I figured she was planning on eating the loser. I flicked off the safety lever near the slide action, something you might not know to do if you were unfamiliar with the weapon, and kept the semi-automatic on the cougar.
"Shoot!"
Leaning on the grill of the Suburban next to Hector, I kept the sidearm trained on the mountain lion but glanced at the Latino. Trickles of blood were running down his face from where the lion's claws had gotten him.
"I think you're annoying her."
The wind blew more gusts of snow, and I could hear footsteps along with a few shouts.
"I think you better tell your friends you haven't got me any more."
He looked at me questioningly.
"Go ahead, yell."
He paused for a second, but I gestured with the gun toward the angry cougar.
"You don't yell, I'm going to let her have you."
The mountain lion continued to snarl and again slapped the roof of the van.
"Hey, he's got my gun, and there's a fucking tiger over here."
I could still hear them moving closer and figured it was time to take action. I might regret the loss of ammunition later, but I needed to back everybody, including the cougar, off. I raised the P226 and fired off a couple of shots. There was more cursing, but I could hear them scrambling back toward the lodge. When I glanced up again, the mountain lion had disappeared. I wedged my shoulder against the grill of the Suburban and peeked over the hood. There wasn't anyone there. When I realized I hadn't breathed in a while, I took a deep one and slowly exhaled, feeling like a portion of my